Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 344. And have I got a good guest for you today? I've been telling you all online that I've been recording some fire podcasts of late. Some mad guests. You're going to really enjoy them. And this week it's Dizzy Rascal. I know a lot of you will be hyped for this one. I know I was hyped to sit down with Dizzy. Our paths have crossed a few times over the years. I'm not going to claim that we're like tight friends from way back, but it was lovely to catch up with Dizzy, and this felt like such a strong chat. I've never heard him this open and this honest in an interview. It felt like a really relaxed and good moment. We're obviously here in part to talk about his new album, E3 AF, out on October 9th, but we talk about so much more as well. If this is your first time tuning in, first of all, you know, a fourth welcome. But go back and check out some previous guests. We've had Kano. We've had Retch 32, Mike Skinner, Roots Maneuver. In 2 weeks, I don't normally give away guests ahead of time, but as I mention it in this podcast, it's weird. I've got Getz coming on in 2 weeks, and I've known Getz a minute as well. And I recorded the Getz one before the Dizzy one, but because of release schedules, the Getz is coming out in 2 weeks' time. So yeah, there's loads to check out, easy to find. If you just search, rather than me give you the episode numbers, if you just search Distraction Pieces and then Kano or Roots Maneuver or Retch or Kate Tempest or whomever else, then you'll find that easy enough. Ashley Waters, Jasmine Jobson, endless list of really good people that I think you'll enjoy. But yeah, for now, you've got a hell of a chat to enjoy. We set this up over Zoom, and we took a while to get headphones sorted. So we'd been chatting for 15 minutes or so before we got rolling. So it might start a little abruptly, because we were kind of like, right, oh, we should be recording, really. But yeah, I hope you enjoy it. I'll say no more. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 344, with Dizzy Rascal. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Oh, well, I'm here with Dizzy Rascal. How you doing, man?
I'm good, sir. How you doing, man?
I'm good. Just as we were getting set up, we were just talking about, I was talking about a bit of the acting I've been doing, and that, and you were saying that even before the music, you were looking into acting, and you went to a little bit of acting class and stuff like that. How was that?
Yeah, so like even from school, you see when you get your options, yeah. Like year 10, I did drama and music, so because yeah. I was just always a performer. So outside of school, mum got me into Anna Shears.
It's that's like legit a drama as well, kind of man. Yeah, that's like loads one. Of good people have gone, Anna Shears. You hear about that all the time as a real...
Yeah. So I went there for like a... Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I went there for like a year, and it was mad for me, because like, I was seeing people like Martin from EastEnders. That's like, he was honest, at the time, he was big on there. Sonia went man. There. Adam Deacon, I used to see him a lot, because he used to go the same days. And then what they do, they put you in groups and then make you go away and make up like a little play or a scene.
Yeah,
but you didn't write it down or nothing like that. You just had to come back and just improvise it. So you had your theme, and then you just had to all kind of work with each other and then basically get to an end of it. If that makes sense.
So that was
I never forgot that. That was like a good thing. But then when I think about it now, okay, I never got into acting really, but I could if I wanted to. But it was good for making you kind of think on your feet.
Yeah.
So between that and pirate radio, so like when we used to do those sets, like you didn't know what the DJ was going to fling on necessarily. Yeah. Yes, you had a little cheeky look or whatever. Like it would just fling on what he flung on, and it's like, oh shit, it's go time. And then you just put whatever bars you had, you'd come out of it in it. Between that and like I said, the acting, that kind of helped you think on your feet. So even if something goes wrong at a massive show, like a proper big one there, don't let it get to us. Like, oh, there's no panic. It's like, well, play it off. Like, it's cool, because you know how to just improvise.
That's perfect. Getting that kind of pressure out of the way at a young age to jump up. Because, again, it's a weird thing, particularly working class families aren't aren't told that acting or music or whatever else is an option. So to be thrown in, now going a perform in front of these people, it's nerve-wracking. So that must have prepared you well for, as you say, radio and performing live, because you've done that. You've jumped up there not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah,
and you've survived.
No scripts. So that's why it was different to, like, it wasn't like a classic acting school like that, you know what I mean? The ones who come from those, like, really serious... Not, it's not a serious, like, because they say it's levels, isn't it?
Yeah.
But never, I don't know how to read a script, or I don't know classical acting or nothing like that. I just but I know how to make some shit up on the spot. You know what I mean?
I love that. I need to see some Dizzy Rascal acting now. That's got to happen in the future. That's got to be a
But like you were saying before we come on, the music videos...
Yeah.
Like, that's why I've always veered towards, like, cinematic music videos, like, ones where, like, I know, it's going to take work. It's going to take work. So, I love doing all that. There's one I did, that was, like, a proper little movie. There's about three that are, like, little mini movies, but the last one I did was Bop and Keep It Dipping.
Yeah.
Like, I had to do some acting and all that. Like, it was wicked, but it is like having a film set. Being on the film set, you've got the director, you have to listen to the director saying all these different things. And there's times there where I get vexed doing it because they keep making you do the same take.
It's repetition.
Right. And he's saying, like, yo, sometimes on movies, you might spend the whole day doing one scene.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? He said, that's what it's like. Like, it's like, yo.
That's been the mad thing for me moving into it, from doing music videos and always doing them as kind of low key, we've got a day to shoot it. Get the whole thing to move into film or TV, and exactly that. You're like all day on this one scene. You're like, this is great. This means we can relax a bit. We can, we can go again. We can get all this set up. It's good. Yeah. But I mean, so you've just announced as we record this the new record, EC3 AF.
E3AF. So it reads as E3 AF.
Yeah.
But the AF is for African, but that's what he used to call us back in the day. He's called, AF is an AF.
Realise that. But so it's clearly referencing, you know, East London has been key in your whole life.
Definitely.
Right, that's where you were part of the birth of grime. And so how is it kind of looking back at things? Like we were talking earlier, you've spent a lot of lockdown in the studio and stuff like that, and someone's been making you reflect on your previous records and that, and a bit rudely and not that positive. But so how is that like when you look back? Because it's been a hell of a journey, and it is kind of a diary of your life and progression, right?
Yeah, with that, even though I don't live there no more, like I'm older, I'm like 35 now. When I was making my first album, like I was kind of like 15, 16, and then it kind of came out officially when I was 18. So I was working on bits from like 16 or whatever, but it was all stemmed from Bo, even though I was making the music in Bermondsey. So Boy in the Corner was made in Bermondsey and Sheffield. That's what a lot of people don't know. Don't let me, because I always do this, I always go off the point, but I just want to try and give you more gems.
I'm good for going off the point, because I think your production is something that gets overlooked a lot, because like I did a club night in East London, just round the corner, and my mate used to do the door at Plastic People at Forward, I was just up the road from that, and even until like when we stopped doing the club night last year, like the beat for I Love You still bangs through a sound system, and people don't really talk about that you were producing.
Yeah, and that's it's interesting for me, because when people talk about me being part of the birth of grime and all that, a pioneer and all that, you've got the whole argument about who's the godfather and all that.
Yeah,
I finally realised that, you lot think I'm an MC. So all this time you've been looking at me as MC and not realising that I was a beat maker.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I brought to grime. Like, the sound. I'm not even getting the credit for it.
Because you were DJing originally, right? DJing and producing.
Jungle.
And then jumping over the top on, Jungle and D&B and stuff like that, right? How was that kind of... Because it's completely overlooked. And I didn't really realise until recently. I think of those early albums and think about your flow and your delivery and the venom of it all.
Yeah,
and just assume that someone else was making the beat. So
it's crazy. Again, like I was in the airport with Disclosure.
Yeah,
one of them said to me, "says Dizzy, who made the beat for Stop That? Who made like the?" I said, "I did that." He said, oh, I thought it was some producer. I said, yeah. So you're right. But how was it? Yeah. So like I said, I started off as a jungle DJ at like 12, 13. Man. So I used to buy records off DJ Target because like we're from like the same estate.
Yeah.
So that's how I used to go to because then he was a very active DJ at the time and jungle producer. Him and DJ Trend were, rest in peace, were linked up. So I used to just go down the road, knock on Target's house and get records from him. Then I took music class in school, but I couldn't learn the musical scale. And see, tea, coffee, lemonade, all that stuff. It just wouldn't register. You know how some people just learn differently?
Yeah.
I could play the drums a bit. But even when they brought a drum teacher to bring me in to try and play it, I couldn't do it the way he did it.
Yeah.
Then the teacher introduced me to Cubase, and that changed everything. Yeah, that's when I learned to make beats. Like, oh, to be fair though, Music 2000 is probably where I learned to make beats. But then that's kind of more of a sequencer. It was just like stuff samples that was already there, innit?
It gets overlooked, man. Music 2000, because it was in a games console, it introduced so many people who wouldn't have thought that they can get into it. Before Cubase and Fruity Loops and all these other things were like an option, fucking about on Music 2000 was the gateway drug kind of thing.
No, definitely. That's like because it was kind of DJing, like I said, just sequencing. But Cubase with just a few basic sounds that I could make a beat.
Yeah,
that's what changed everything. That's when I was the beginnings of me being a producer.
What made me think about it was on Instagram, you posted a video recently of you messing about with the I Love You beat on some trigger pads.
Yeah.
And again, all people were like shocked and surprised. It's like, no, that's, you made that. That's
how I made it.
This isn't like 10 years on or 20 years or whatever on, you're going, I'm going to try and do it all myself now. It's like, no, that's how it always was.
Me recreating how I did it.
Yeah.
But you know what's crazy as well? Everything these days is documented. Like, probably my most seminal album that most people will think of, like, is my seminal album, even though I've got Tongue in Cheek, was massive as well, bigger, really, sales-wise. But Boy in the Corner, there's no documenting footage of anything. Because I was just so in the zone, we didn't even think to record any footage of anything. So nobody knows anything. Yeah. Nobody's ever seen anything from it.
Yeah.
Like, we just didn't even think of that. So that's why...
Well, you don't know at that point. You don't know what's it's going to be or how important it might be
at all. Moments. And anyone who says they did, I don't know. I don't know if they knew it was going to be this big. You're just kind of just getting on with it. It was it. But anyway, that introduced me to production. And part of the reason I produced as well is because I didn't really have a choice. Who could I get beats from at 17 or 16 anyway? There's no one I could even get any beats from. So I had to kind of learn to do it. Then went from different studios. And then really it was down to, okay, the engineer at the time, one of them who I've never called up, shouted out enough, it was Danny C. And another one called Danny S. Because at the time, they worked in the studio in Deptford. I can't remember who I went to first. But I remember it being confusing because I worked with Danny C, then I went to work with Danny S, and they were next door to you, and they were mates. But they were like garage producers. But at the time, now I'm older, I realised, okay, they'd load up like a sound bank for me.
Yeah.
And then I had a bunch of samples. I was sampling like 3-6 Mafia stuff. One tune which was called Who Run It. So I'd sampled the Crunchy Black thing from that. And then I had a tune that I made at Danny C or Danny S, I can't remember, which was called Cram. So I sampled that, but then I was using their drum sounds and their bass lines and all that, and that was my first productions, like proper ones, for in a proper studio. I made another one called Ready for War before that, but I was young. That's when I was hanging around with Nasty Crew. It's called Ready for War. But and then the next one I made after Crime was another one called Bwear Them About. Again, I was using 3-6 Mafia samples, but within their studios. So that's basically when I had variety of different sounds and samples before I even really knew what that was, because it basically load up a sample bank and spread it across the keyboard like that.
And
I just find the bits I want. And I could still put a beat and all that together, but that's what was being done in it. Whereas with Cubase, you just got the basic sounds.
Yeah.
So I learned on that, and then Boy in the Corner's kind of made in the same way. A lot of those sounds were Cage's. Cage is my manager now. He had, because he's a producer before, so he had that library of sounds and samples and keyboards and whatever, and they just laid him out on the, laid them out across the cable for me, and I picked them. So that's why Boy and Corn just sound so mad, because the sounds that I picked were different. The crazy thing is, me, Danny Weed, Wiley, Target, we use the same computer, we use the same studio, we use the same shit.
It's mad, isn't it? Yeah.
That's what, another thing people don't know, we use the same shit. I just chose mad different sounds because, like I said, my influence is different. Everything from drum and bass to grunge to dancehall to garage, all types of different shit. So my mind was just a bit more... I didn't mind just making stuff so dirty and just so mad and off-key. That's what I was about, like. And I still am now.
And that's what's interesting as well. I remember in around 2007 or 2008, we did a fair few festivals. And at that point, you'd drop, like, a Nirvana beat or something and rap over the top. And it felt from the outside, potentially, that you're going, oh, we're at these indie gigs. Because at those shows, it was only you... Me and Dan Lesac and Bizzle, who were doing any rapping, who were doing everything else, was indie bands and rock bands. But what I kind of read up later was that's what you grew up listening to. You read Kerrang, you listened to Nirvana.
Kerrang, Hammer, all that stuff. And that came from, because it started off with someone on my estate being into like Jimi Hendrix and all that. And then the next door neighbor was into the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and then he introduced me to that, and I was like, "Rah, I just love that Iron Maiden and Guns N' Roses and then eventually Korn, Sepultura, and all that." Yeah. It's just that it's at the weight.
Yeah.
Because when we start talking about Korn, especially Korn, the bottom end.
Yeah.
It had the grit, but at the bottom end of hip hop on drum and bass, which is crazy because at the time I wasn't as into hip hop then. I'm talking about when I was like 10, 11. Yeah. I was more into it because I wasn't getting much hip-hop back then, because them times there, you could only get hip-hop on the TV. I wasn't listening to Westwood. And then there was no one around me feeding me hip-hop like that. It's only one of my friends at school, his brother, he got a Snoop Dogg CD from his tape from his brother and gave it to me. So that's as much hip-hop as I knew, and Tupac and all that. But I was really into the heavy metal and all that. But like I said, Korn and the not so much Limp Bizkit, but especially Korn, but a Nirvana. And again, when I think back to it, Nirvana was quite... The drums were big in Nirvana. Maybe not so much the early stuff, but when it got to, like, Nevermind in Neurotoro, the bottom end was sick, innit?
Yeah, yeah. It hit you in the gut, right?
Yeah, and it was soulful, or not soulful, I would say euphoric.
Yeah.
In a dark, kind of moody way.
Yeah.
And then they just had some other stuff that was just like, sludge. You know that song, Milk It?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By Nirvana... That's like my favorite Nirvana song, if you think about it, because it's just nuts. It just starts off ding, ding, all nuts, and then it's, you know what I'm talking about? So that the spirit of that has always been with me. So when you hear I Love You, that's like, I was never gonna make like stuff with guitars in it because I couldn't play guitar.
Yeah.
Like a lot of that music there is because I couldn't play. When we got to that point of using guitars and all that, was, I guess, obviously Fix Up the Shot, but it was a sample, and I was thinking of the rock element of it, and just kind of going playing off of a tune that had some singing in it, and what I thought was like old school hip hop.
Yeah.
And overall, it was a dub plate for Tim Westwood. I needed to make a rap tune, but it wasn't very current, to be fair, because at that time, rap was like Dipset.
Yeah.
But I didn't have access to Just Blaze and all that.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But Cage had the Billy Squire record there. So, okay, let's do that. That's the closest I can get to hip-hop right now. That's what that.
Yeah.
But, say, moving forward, by the time we got to Sirens, actually me playing on the drum and me playing a one string on the guitar and Nick distorting it, Cage distorting it. And then
love it.
Where we get to that point of the... See the end where it breaks down and goes into the Korn thing, just like you're saying. Because now, by this time, it's my third album. So I'm actively... Like you said, thinking of those festivals that I do that are not the underground, like, gram thing no more. So it was actually, we stuck Korn Here to Stay on the end of it originally.
But then
it's when Cage come through to say, like, no, let's go and get it re. Because I didn't understand, you had to go and give away so much money or whatever else it was. So he got people that they just played something like it. So if you listen to it, it is actually based off of Here to Stay.
Yeah.
So that influence has always been there.
My whole first album was that I made it kind of with all these samples, and then I found out I can't do that, and we went in a studio and played something that sounds quite like it, but not like it enough to get sued and have to give people money and that. It's a
And you know what's mad as well? But almost like it's almost a sad thing at the same time as well, because those albums, was it 33 Feet? No, what was the
3 Feet and Rising, De La Soul, that they sampled everything, and yeah,
it's so amazing. Like, there's a era of stuff like that.
Yeah,
a lot of hip hop, even the boom bap stuff, you just can't. It's a shame that unless you want to fork out, most people don't. You're not even going to hear stuff like that. But then what you've got now, you see, like the Griselda thing. You see, did you hear the Griselda album?
No.
So Griselda's like the closest thing you're going to get to that kind of 2005 gritty kind of East Coast hip hop.
Some
gangster shit, drug dealing music.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a lot of that old sample shit, but a lot of it is Beat Butcher making samples.
Yeah.
And then his guy, Darringer. Darringer, I think his name. That's the main producer on it. Chopping it up. So their album sounds like some classic rap shit, sampled shit, but the samples have actually been made to sound like or some classic.
They built them themselves.
Yeah, that's where we're at now. Unless you're fucking someone with a crazy budget like a Kanye West or something who don't care.
You can just take anything you want.
So
do you think estate life makes you grow up quicker and get that diversity in quicker, I guess? Because as I said, you're around people. The fact that you were saying I was DJing at like 12, I recorded a podcast with Getz last week, and I've known him years, and it wasn't until we sat down and did the podcast that we were talking about him being like locked up at 15, and he said it was speaking to you that put him on the right path, because he was seeing people like you blow up, but then actually speaking to you and you saying, look, when you get out, you can be getting on this music thing. Like it's a thing now. It's an option. It's not just we're either on road or sports. Do you know what I mean?
You're taking me back, man.
I know, I'm telling you.
Conversation, that's mad. Because, obviously, me and Getz used to run around together as kids.
Yeah.
He wasn't a musician, and I wasn't like a known MC. And we know for travel through Storming and a couple of other brethren, isn't it? But if he's 15, Getz is like a year above me, so I would have been about 14, 15.
Yeah.
So I used to go over to his way, around Ilford, he kind of plastered. No, a minute, it's next door, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's mad that you're saying that there, yeah.
Because again, he was saying that at that age, particularly in a lot of those areas, if the only success you're seeing is drug dealers, Or people doing illegal shit, then that's the only option. Whereas if you're seeing blowing up that you actually know, that's the difference, right?
Though definitely to an extent. But the other crazy thing there is, first up, it was weird as a black kid for me to be into that stuff that we were talking about.
Yeah,
100%. Heavy metal and all that. So there was that. People looking at me like I was crazy anyway for that. So I had to get over
that. The opposite with hip hop. Like, I was into all my heavy metal and my punk with my little white mates, and then I was into all my rap, and they were all like,
okay,
what's going on? This isn't
right. Okay, so there was all that. But as far as the estate and all that, it's mad. I never overly wanted to be a shotter, or I had my little phases where I'd run around with people and all that, but I saw what it was early.
Yeah.
I think I clocked the shit side of it, and by then I was so into what I was doing musically that my friends would still be around me, but when I clocked it, and I was getting money, so it didn't appeal to me, that side of it.
Yeah.
Too tough. And then on the flip side as well, I know talk about influences and all that. I don't want to name names, but you still got a lot of people that were, whatever, drug dealers or whatever, but they were still, I guess it goes to his point, actually, is like they were doing constructive things. Like, a lot of the raves and the pirate radio stations wouldn't have existed without drug dealers and gun runners or whatever they were doing at the time. I don't want to name names.
No, of course.
At the same time, you still had those influences there. So even living in the hood, just seeing drug dealers and all that. But sometimes the drug dealers weren't just drug dealers.
Yeah.
Is that making sense?
Yeah. Or again, it's that means to an end, isn't it? But it's if you can make it a means to an end, it should be kind of anything I'm doing is to get out of this situation, but that situation can drag you in and hold you there, right? So if you're getting out of it by putting on shows, putting on radio...
I wouldn't even want to give them even more credit than that, because it couldn't have just been about them trying to make money.
Yeah.
Because even running a station was a pretty shitty thing.
Yeah.
And pretty,
Yeah.
So that was the passion.
Yeah.
Even putting on the raves, it's still like, unless they were shot in there with drugs, I don't know the ins and the outs of what was doing personally.
Yeah.
But the passion they had for the music was bigger than, you know what I mean, than the other shit. They paid their bills, they got their little nice bits and bobs and all that. But a lot of them put so much money into the thing. Like, I don't think it was just about getting out of the hood. Like, they cared. They were some of them own record labels. They don't care. Anyone I've been around like that, criminal or whatever, with all that, they care.
Yeah.
So it's seeing that passion as much as like seeing, there's a way out of the hood. I don't think I ever, even if I said that on song, I don't think I ever felt like, music's my way out of, it was never about that. Like, I never looked at it like, music saved my life or another. I never looked at it like that. I was just so obsessed. Yeah. And I think Getz was too.
Because
it was just that thing of when he clocked that he could be an MC and then he clocked up, rah, he's good. Like, he's really good. He jumped up a bunch of levels. He started late, but then just jumped up levels to the point where it's like, and that side over there in Newham, very lyrical dons.
Yeah.
From young, like Kano, Sharky, Getz. He come off the back of that already. It was already laid. Them guys are lyrical.
Yeah.
It's wicked. But like I said, it was about the passion more than anything, I think.
I love that. I'm gonna continue taking you back a bit right now. I'm a Millwall fan, and I wouldn't normally mention that to someone from East London because it causes issues. But I remember reading an interview in a programme once with a defender that we had who I love called Danny Shittu.
Yeah, Danny Shittu.
And he spoke about growing up with you and coming up with you, and you used to go around his and play records and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where was that? Like, how was that in your upbringing?
So Daniel was my mum are like that from when I was a baby. But then I didn't meet him again until I got to a little bit older and started to get a bit more troublesome. So basically his estate was behind mine. So he's in the estate behind mine, which funnily enough is the same estate Jonathan Ross grew up on randomly.
Really?
Yeah, that's where he's originally from before he moved to Leytonstone. He's from Bedette Estate. So then with Daniel, so I got to that age where I started going over, and I can't remember, I just started going over to them because they were like the other set of black family or people, whatever, but just in the opposite direction. And then Nigeria, so it's the African thing, so we were just tight. They just automatically become your cousins and all that. You're tight. But Daniel's one of them things, he was an inspiring guy because he didn't really get into trouble. He was big. Everyone respected him. He could knock everyone out.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a troublemaker. Lad. Yeah. But he was tough and no one messed with him. But he was a go-getter. So Daniel, anything he put his mind to, he did it. So he just became like a big inspiration between him and Wiley at that time when I was in there. They were like people I looked up to.
Yeah.
So Daniel, he's decided he wanted to DJ. So at his decks, he DJed. So I'd go there and DJ with him. I just follow him, whatever he did. And then he decided he wanted to fix computers and sell computer parts. So we go Sunday Market. You know Sunday Market? Before they changed that. And then he'll be buying parts because we used to go to church and then like we'll leave church while it's on and we'll spend 3 or 4 hours in the Sunday Market, be getting bits. Then he decided he wanted to play softball. Then he ended up playing softball for the UK and travelling around the world. Then he got into football late through Nick Friday. Nick Friday was a scout from my area who was always like a youth leader in youth clubs and all that. It was always about he got Daniel scouting and all that. And then Daniel ended up being a professional footballer. So he's a dude that I just watched do everything.
Yeah, and just do it. Not think about it or ask or see if I can, ask if you're allowed. Just go, I'm doing this now.
He just jumped from thing. He had his brother. They were just super positive guys.
I loved
that. Like, they just just had my back. I just loved rolling with him. That was that. I was young then. I was like 15. Yeah.
I love that. So you speak of people 14. Inspiring you then, but so how was it when Boy in the Corner proper blew up? Because that, again, there's a responsibility there because you're bringing the scene forward, like the Mercury Award and stuff like that. That hadn't been seen in grime before, and the mainstream kind of attention that was on your music. So how was that? And obviously, there's also always backlash in any underground scene. As soon as someone starts to get big, people start to question them and come from. So how was it initially when that just was getting bigger and bigger and bigger?
If I'm honest, bro, I don't think I really understood.
Yeah.
Or there was no reference. I didn't know what I was supposed to be thinking or feeling because I just went from yeah, whatever, underground raves, like really underground ones, at like clubs like Rex or EQ or other little places like that around London, similar to that. And then it stepped up when you got to like Sidewinder. That's when it became like nationwide. Like, I would never have met anyone from Liverpool or Manchester or Leeds and all them places if it weren't for that rave. That was the step up. And then it went from there to a few festivals maybe, and then to Mercury and all that. And then just going to the label, little things like going to the record label, sitting down and doing 11 interviews and having to answer the same questions and all that. That's what my life was at that point.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to know or expect. I didn't really know what the Mercury Award was. I remember being in Iron Apple and seeing that Miss Dynamite won it. That was my introduction to the Mercury Award.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what the Mercury was. I just know, oh, Miss Dynamite's in the paper. She won this thing. And then the next year, I won it. And Miss Dynamite gave it to me. But I didn't know. Mad. Because by them times there, I didn't know much about the music industry other than, okay, I came up around Pay As You Go and More Fire.
Yeah.
At that point, after Soul Solid and that, were the dudes I get from East or from within my kind of radius or area had been into the mainstream or been into the proper music industry.
Yeah, yeah.
But other than that, I had no reference. I knew what the Brits was because the Brits was on telly as the biggest award. I knew what the Mobo Awards because that was the Black Brits.
Yeah,
You know what I mean? But at the time, I didn't really know nothing. I used to... I remember... It's quite crazy. My manager took me to Nando's for the first time ever to meet Richard Dickey's... Adele's...
Right.
Manager.
Yeah. I know.
That's the first time I went to Nando's. Like, my first time being, when there was like a little bidding war, going to meet all these different people who wanted to sign me.
Yeah.
All those things there. Like, again, I'm not really understanding, but I've never had chicken like this before. Like, that's, you know what I'm saying? That's where I was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Wow, Nando's, Elephant and Castle. Oh my God, this is crazy. Like that kind of shit. I didn't know enough about anything. And then as far as the scene turning on me and all that, I don't think I really understood. It's not like today where you could see everything that was being, how everyone feels about you on your comment section.
Yeah, of course.
So you just hear it through, I don't know, an MC might say something on a radio set, or so you got little vibes like. But then, at some point, I kind of just cut all of that out because it was affecting your music. Because you start finding that raw, you're just writing aggressive music for other MCs when you could just be writing songs. There's that wider thing.
Yeah.
So after all that, I started touring with Justin Timberlake, and I learned about, okay, you need other songs with stuff that people can sing along to, not just stop that, get that.
Yeah,
like they're tolerating it and that, but that's what I learned. It's been loads of learning curves. It's been crazy still.
I love it because it's, again, it's true. It shows that you're learning, again, as we said with Danny Shittu, you're learning by doing. You're going out there and doing it, and you're going, right, I'm playing live now. There's only so much of this kind of song that works, or even that you might enjoy doing live. You need that variation, and it's a weird one. Again, I talked to Getz about this. I talked to Kano about it. Is grime came about because someone was trying to do something different?
Yeah,
and then everyone kind of started to do the same thing, or anyone who stepped aside from it would then get hate for it not being grime. It's like, well, no, the point is to evolve music and push it forward, right?
Do you know, some of it comes from, see, when the scenes starts to get established,
yeah,
it kind of starts to have its own hierarchy.
Yeah.
So you kind of can't get in anyway. So like, even if I would have wanted to be in Garage, I knew that whether Spoony and all them people were already looking, I guess Soul Solid more close, was closer to them, and looking at everything that was coming after that, it's like, we don't like that vibe. And we were after that.
Yeah.
So even though Wiley was a Garage thing, he made the transition, he was in Garage, he was in drum and bass before that, but then he saw really truly what I was doing,
yeah,
and then that made him flip his music, and he changed his style of doing it because he was making Garage. And then when we got together, like we were in the same crew and all that, so it is where it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
But like I said, the hierarchy, so eventually guys just end, you end up just making your own thing anyway. We couldn't get into the Garage room, so they gave us our own small room at the rave. But then our room became the room because our radio sets just became bigger and cooler. The music was making just became more interesting. Just like all these different crews started popping up in East, and in South, North, West. And so it just became its own thing. And then what ended up happening is that became its own hierarchy. So a lot of these kids now that are like doing Afro swing or drill, aside from rap music, which some of them are obviously doing, some of them were into grime. Some of them were grime MCs who couldn't get through the hierarchy.
Is
that making sense?
Yeah, completely.
That's what ends up happening. I guess a lot of, like, same with drum and bass. Like, guys were in dubstep and all that, maybe couldn't, they were obviously into drum and bass, innit? But then they just end up becoming bigger in the, and their thing just becomes something else.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how was it then, as you said, when you're getting influenced by, I mean, touring with people like Justin Timberlake and shit like that is craziness.
Random.
So how is it when that kind of influence comes in? Because that Dance With Me and Bonkers and Holiday era was when shit got bigger than ever. And again, obviously, any backlash or whatever as well. But I want to say now, I still put Bonkers up there lyrically and flow-wise with anything. Like the succinctness and explosiveness of that verse is classic Dizzy Rascal cunning. So how was that to be doing these new or playing with this new sound in front of so many people and seeing it work in these huge festivals and all of these places?
That shit just went off immediately. So I knew it was right. It went off. But aside from what I told you about, the natural progression of being in these different environments and understanding, like, oh, you need different songs for different dynamics and you need to carry a 70-minute set.
Yeah.
But when the Justin Timberlake thing, when I did that, I had two albums. So I had Boy in the Corner and Showtime. And there wasn't a lot of commercial stuff on there. Like, the most commercial thing, other than Fix Up the Sharks, probably Stand Up Tall, which was an attempt kind of at a commercial version of Pulse X, which is why I got Youngster at that beat, which was the Pulse X beat, but he put a bunch of other stuff on it, and then I tried to make something that wasn't so aggressive as the hook.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's still him anyway, so that was his tune. But basically, with Dance With Me and Holiday and all that, as much as that progression, that was just me, I guess it was by my third album, I guess that's when Calvin Harris came out with Acceptable in the 80s.
Yeah.
That was a case of me just sitting there and just seeing that on the telly, like seeing that video on the TV, Acceptable in the 80s, and just hearing things like, rah, what's that? Because that was different when it came out.
Yeah, yeah,
it was like, it sounded like some 80s funk stuff. Nothing sounded like that, though.
Yeah.
So I was like, rah, who's that? That's sick. And then he put out a few other bits, and then I think, like, rah, it'd be good to get a beat from him. And then eventually I met him. I think it was Radio 1 Big Weekend. I met him at Radio 1, and I said to him, like, introduced myself to him, like, yo, like, whatever year it was the year Rihanna just dropped Umbrella, because I remember she was there, and I met her manager. And then I met Calvin Harris, and I told him, like, yo, I love what you're doing, man. Let's do something. I think he was surprised. But I was like, yeah. And by this time, I was on my third album. So this is when I've got Sirens and all that. That's where I was at.
Yeah.
But I heard him. I was like, and I guess I could hear the pop potential. Not even necessarily pop. I didn't know how to make pop music.
Yeah.
I didn't know about pop production. Like, I had no access to it. And we kind of shunned that by not signing to whatever, Polydor or whoever else at the time, there was a bidding war, wanted to automatically straight away make me into what they thought a pop artist would be. That's why I went with XL, because when I spoke to Richard Russell or whatever, it would have been, anyway, it'll come to me, whatever. But speaking to them, they didn't want to change me.
Yeah.
So yes, I wasn't trying to be a pop star anyway, but I heard that Calvin Harris tune, except when the 80s, and just the quirkiness, that's it was quirky. It lit up. I'm a dude, I love sounds, whether it's, like you said, hard, crazy, or just quirky, even West Coast funk stuff. And I heard that with him. So then what ended up happening is I wrote Dance With Me to a Groove Armada beat. Groove Armada sent me something. So then I wrote to it, and I sent it to my manager, and he says, yo, this is good, but this is almost a bit too good for this beat. Like, no disrespect to them, because I did some of their, they used to, they had the Ring festival at Vicky Park.
Yeah,
I got nothing for them, innit? But it just didn't fit. And it's not the first time where I'd put lyrics from something else on song. Fix Up the Sharp, those lyrics didn't start on that beat.
Yeah.
Like, I used to do that a lot. So then end up getting a beat from Calvin Harris. He sent it, and I remember recording it, then brought in Chrome, who was a friend of Footsie's at the time. Then Nick wrote some bits and that as well, and then it all got produced up or whatever. Calvin produced it, obviously. And then it became that.
Yeah.
And at the time, it kills me. People think, the record, he went mainstream, the record label made him. Like, nah. I was actually at the end of my deal with XL. I had a 3-album deal. So by the time I got to Maths and English, third album, I was done. We took Dance With Me to them, and they didn't want that because they did. I don't think they were interested in me and going that direction. I had three gold albums. I'd done as much as that. I'd done everything they wanted me to do at that point. You know what I mean? So I had to make the decision to go in fully independent. It was like going back to how I started when we were selling white labels and putting them in the boot and taking them to the record shops. I just saw it as a bigger version of that.
Yeah.
So I was up for it. And then we shot that cheap video. And at the time, it was a 10 grand video, which was cheap for back then. Now you could get a decent video for 10 grand. Back then, we shot in the Notting Hill Arts Centre, just invited a bunch of whoever else, some of the girls or different girls that I was seeing at the time, whatever, just a bunch of random shit going on in the video, innit? But then it just worked. It was number one for a month. Yeah. A month. And then
madness.
You know what I'm saying? And then that was the beginning of that, I guess, the process of that album. So we had to get another one from Calvin, obviously, naturally, innit? So then that was Holiday. It came out after Bonkers. Bonkers was the second one, but Holiday came out third. And then even with that, that was a bit of ahead of his time because I remember Calvin, I was having this conversation. I wrote it, put it on that beat, and I loved it. But then he said he wants to do this bit at the end where it speeds up and goes into some big house thing. And I was I don't know, you know? I weren't with it.
Yeah.
But he had to, he was adamant about it. So, I kind of let him do it. And in the end, that sound, that dun, 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 just became the sound for the next few years, to the point where Chris Brown was doing it. You know what I'm talking about, innit?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rihanna was doing it. Everyone was doing it as that big turnaround at the end as well, yeah.
And then, Calvin Harris ended up doing that Rihanna tune,
innit? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I basically got onto Calvin Harris early. So, it's not that I was trying to become this massive pop star. And it's not like I'm doing anything that label were trying to make me do because I didn't have the support of the label. Most record labels, that's what they'd love that for eyes, but that's not what they were trying to do, innit?
Yeah.
So I actually went against the grain, even though it looks like I was fully pandering and catering to the mainstream and all that. First up, the mainstream didn't sound like that.
Yeah.
I know it's hard to think of that now.
Well, that's it, because after it did. I've known Example for years, and when I had him on, at that point, when Example blew up in his kind of pop version
with Calvin Harris.
Yeah, with Calvin Harris. Yeah. It's because that's what a label were looking for, that sound. They were like, we want it to be this. And they were looking for an MC or front person to do that. But it's fascinating to hear that obviously you'd done three albums with XL and they completely aren't a label who are going to be trying to push you in any pop direction. Don't to hear that it's like, no, here's just the music I made. And then we found the majors, and it found its major market rather than the other way around.
It found the majors. It had major success, but I was independent.
Yeah.
That whole album, Platinum, Bonkers, thing, all that was in the... I wasn't signed to anybody. That's the crazy thing about it.
I didn't even realise that at all. In my mind, that must have been major label.
Because it was that big and it worked so well that it just seems big and shiny and thingy, but no, it wasn't. All the artists are talking about their independent guys now. That's really what it was.
It's mad when you look back on it all as well, because XL as well, at that point, XL weren't what they are now. They hadn't had Adele become the biggest artist in the world. They were an independent label.
No, they were a massive independent label.
Yeah, they were the biggest in England. Yeah.
But I remember watching Adele's... I remember the XL doing the showcase. And the showcase was it in a cinema?
Yeah.
It was in a cinema. Yeah, and they premiered the Sirens video.
Yeah.
And it was like, right, everyone was wild and rat. And then this girl got up on stage with her guitar and plays on a song. I was like, rah. She's the truth. And it was Adele. It went from there, innit?
I gigged with Adele a load in them days. And I remember when she got on Jules Holland, and the traditional thing is everyone adds this big production, all this. And it was XL who were like, no, we need to just put her up there, as they would have done at that showcase. So we need to just put her on stage with a guitar because that's more impactful than strings and keys and all these other things because... Yeah, as the impact it said then, it makes you go, oh, shit, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
So what are the kind of two questions here? What are the influences now on the new record? Because as I said, it's dope to hear that it is always just what's jumping out to you. And how have you felt about the booming grime? Because the first time it did kind of hit a wall. You and a few others kind of moved on and grime kind of got stuck a little bit. And then it's kind of come back bigger than ever at the moment, it seems. Like, how's that been to watch as one of the originators?
To watch as one of the originators is half acceptance that it's gone in the next direction, and you can kind of try and jump in if you want, but kind of at the same time, you're here.
Yeah.
In a way. So then what have you got to add to it? Are you going to fully commit to what's going on there, even though you're not necessarily into all of it, or they're not necessarily all into you?
Yeah.
Like or they're into one side of you.
Yeah, that's key, right? Yeah, yeah.
So it's just like there's that. And then the other side of it is kind of like, well, another part is that, see that he's saying it looked like it seemed like it hit a wall. Is this knowing that it's not that it hit a wall, it hit a wall as far as like being a chart music.
Yeah.
Because it's a sound system culture.
Yeah.
So a lot of those guys, like Getz and all them, were in the beginning, guys that were just, they would go on radio and just spray because that was the release. It was like a hobby. It's like going to play football or something, but we just go on radio, have our bars ready, and just want to just be the best MC. There's as much that element to it too.
Yeah.
And everybody wasn't built to make so. And I'm sure it's the same with all jazz. When jazz was started, there'd have been guys that could just do play better than everyone, but they couldn't necessarily put it to a song.
Yeah.
And have hit after hit after hit after hit. So there's, so then eventually, not that it fades into the background, it just becomes more niche, or it's just that culture. If you want a bit of that, you just go and get a bit of that. It happens with drum and bass, it happens with garage. Like every now and then, you just have, because of the record labels, like you say, when they see something working, they'll run to it and sign a bunch of stuff thingy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When one jungle hit comes out and it has a massive success thing, then it seems like there's jungle coming everywhere. And then it happens with garage. Oh, there's someone just had a garage hit out of nowhere. Quickly, just go and sign it and a bunch of. So that's why it always seems like. Stuff big,
yeah.
And then things like it dies out because everyone's not a hit maker. Going back to the credit of pop's like a dirty word, but to actually make a pop tune is not that easy.
Nah,
it's actually
not
easier
at all.
It's easier to make, say, like one of my songs, Stop That, or whatever. It's actually easier to make just a hard banging grime tune where I'm just banging my chest.
Yeah.
Than it is to make a tune that'll make 100,000 people at Glastonbury all jump round together. They don't know each other and just like euphoric. Like,
yeah.
that's hard.
Well, I mean, speaking of jumping around together and euphoric, we've mentioned Jungle a few times. I want to quickly talk about, it's one of my favourite clips of all time, is when everyone was in with, was it with Charlie Slough and General Levy?
No, it
wasn't with Slough, was it?
Mr. Jam,
of course. And General Levy came in and did Incredible. And that was like, how was that? Because it felt like that was everyone returning to being young kids in the booth all together, all having that energy and excitement. Because, was a track, right?
It's mad because I didn't go there for that.
Yeah.
I went there because I had a track with Fecky. It was Fecky's song. Fecky and Splurge were sampled my song Sitting Here and made a new thing with it. So I was going with Fecky to the radio to promote that with him.
Yeah.
We just got to do an interview. But we was waiting outside and then man were doing a set. And it's like, well, it's JME. I see JME and Bizzle.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realise the link between me and Morfire Crew. I'm actually on their first album.
Yeah.
That is my first... Yeah. The first album I appeared on was the Morfire Crew album. Like, with my own... I produced the song. It's called Still the Same. I made the beat, everything.
Yeah.
So it's like, me and Lethal go so way back. It's like, well, how are we standing out here? They're in there. Like, we might as well just, like, go in there and just vibe with them. So we just walked in. And Abyssal was just so happy to see me because I hadn't seen him for years. Like I said, we see each other every now and then in passing at festivals. But you know, it's sometimes you're sometimes you don't, innit? So it was just a vibe. And it's General... I never met General Levy, but I know what... fucking Incredible meant to me.
100%.
I've still got that there. I've got my little record collection back there.
Yeah.
Like, I've still got that. Like, that was a tune that was automatic, that it got played on every jungle set I did when I was 14 or whatever.
Yeah.
So to have him there doing it, just have him in... No, it didn't happen like that. He was waiting as well.
Oh, really?
So me and Fecky and all that went in, then we just started bubbling with Skepta and all them there. We started just doing a set like we would. And then General Levy came in on that.
Because that was it. It seemed
mad.
That's what was beautiful about it. Was it seemed like that? It seemed like none of this was planned. Everyone was just passing by. And again, that's what's that's where the energy and the buzz comes from. And again, it's similar because, as you were saying, like, people don't know that you and Wiley and numerous others were all using, like, the same studio at that time back in the day and all this kind of thing. So it's a similar thing there of you don't get it as much when you've had that success. Like, you don't have those things where you just, you're walking past the studio and you jump in. It has to be all planned and scheduled. So it felt like a real energising thing to see people just go, oh, fuck it, look, I know those guys. Let's go and jump in on that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And some of this album was made like that, where I was just hitting guys up, like, you know what, rah? Let me hit up Chip. Like, comes to the studio. Like, listens to a bunch of shit. Right, he likes this, he picked that, he jumped on it. Gets and Kano, got them both on the tune. But that came through Chubby Dread hitting me up, who made Oyer for More Fire Crew.
So
I've known him so back then. Man, and he made a tune on my album called Round We Go. But then, man, I didn't see him for years.
He's responsible for some damaging clubs, man. Because when Oi came out, that was shit would get rowdy in those.
He is responsible for 140 BPM.
Really?
It wasn't 140 BPM.
Right.
He did that.
Amazing.
Because nothing on Boy in the Corner is 140 BPM that I know of.
Yeah.
He brought that tempo. So that's what he's responsible for. So,
it's amazing.
He at the time, well, because he was in there, so he told me, Oi was like Garage. That was him making Garage, but because of whatever, it ended up becoming his own style. Yeah. But it was to cater to, like, Garage. Like.
Yeah.
So I see him, like, in the last, 15, 16 years or something, I might have seen him twice. So when Fabric opened a new club, Matter, see him in Matter when Matter was popping, like, maybe it was like 10 years ago now, innit? And then I didn't see him again for ages because he moved out of town. And then he just hit me up randomly, like, in 2017. I was like, right, what's going on? And we linked up, went to the studio, he played me a bunch of things. And I was like, yo, we need to get some. And I think I see Getz in traffic on Old Street. But there was, we drove with Justin Knowledge, because we hadn't seen each other for so long. Wow, go on. And then I ended up inviting to the studio, played it for him, and then he set it off.
Yeah.
So then okay, I need to put my verse down. And then on a separate occasion, like, thinking, like, who could do this? Who could top this off? Kano. It has to be Kano. Me and Chubby, Kano. It has to be Kano. Yeah. We're someone, again, we all know each other from young, but never done a song. So then brought Kano to the studio, separate occasion. He come, he heard what he had to do. I had to go and do a corporate event somewhere. So I went away, did that, came back, and then he put down some disgustingness and just completed the thing. Yeah. But then that was a fun way of doing things, like, not so all, like, just vibes. A lot of the album was made like that. A lot of the album, and that is a wicked way to work, you know, sometimes just walking in on people's session and shit like that. That's how the Skepta song happened. It's not on the album, it came out before.
Yeah.
But we was just in the same building.
Oh, really?
And one day I just walked in his door, I heard he was there, I walked in, he saw me, just gave me a hug, we were just cool, and then we just started chatting. Because sometimes you just don't see people for ages. You don't know what the vibes are. And then you get chatting and that, then show you something, and then you just end up with a song. That's like, when it's like that, it's cool, you know what I mean? But where we've all got to levels where we've been in the music industry, like, things change a bit. That makes sense. Like,
yeah, completely. Like I said, and it's mad to think that when Getz and Kano were doing their, like, Nasty Crew thing and all that in the day, you'd think there's got to be a track that they were on with you. That's got to have happened. So it's mad that at this point, it's like, and again,
I took Kano to record his first song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I took him to Boys and Girls. I took him to the studio, and then he made it. I think it was Danny C or they're one person now.
One of the Dannys.
One of the Dannys. I took him there, and that's what they went and made that. So I'm sure that's the studio I took him to. So we've got history, and we used to be on sets. We've been on sets, but not Nasty Crew. Yeah. We was on Flavor FM. But we was all on the same station. But it sits with me and Kano. I don't know if they're on tape, but he was always like a feared MC.
Yeah.
Like, if he gets on the mic, like I said, that's what I'm talking about. The passion behind it was not about money back then. Money came into it eventually. Like, we're all paid now. Everyone's all right. But at that point there, it was a sport.
Yeah.
It was just sport. Like, it mattered who was the best MC. It wasn't even all just vibes.
Oh, Kano always popped out in that way. because of how laid back it all seemed. Like Getz, again, you can't not look at him. He's got that energy. He's going for it. And Kano had come in kind of calm and then build. And it was, yeah, it stands out, right? It's scary.
But what's crazy, yeah, is that you're right. You're right. Because, but that's who Getz was outside.
Yeah.
That's the Getz I remember, like, as a youth.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That set of youths there, when they come, something's going to happen. Like, someone's going to get robbed. Something's going to happen. But with Kano and that, he was a suave. He's always a suave youth. It just, when he gets around, he's suave. He already knows he's better than most of the people there. And like, it is what it is. But with this tune, he went mad.
Really?
This tune with me, forget there, he went mad. He went mad.
Because that's the most exciting thing with Kano on his last record on SYM. He kind of, again, he starts all chilled, and when he blows up, man, yeah, your hair stand on end. So yeah, this sounds exciting. Was that a conscious thing then, that you wanted to do a record that made you feel like those days, that was just getting people in and not being this kind of planned or any kind of marketing type thing, just going, who's good on this?
I think
let's
it's
get people in the room.
Yeah, a bit of that, but I think it's because I started producing again.
Yeah.
I started producing with the last EP, but then I made a conscious effort, like, nah, right now, like, I'm making beats.
Yeah.
So it's more about I wanting to have people on my beats. And the first actual tune that we decided, like, okay, this is the beginning of an album or a project, was the one with P Money on it.
Right.
Which is actually the intro song.
Yeah.
So I brought him to the studio. He's the first person I brought in, actually.
Yeah.
To hear everything and all that, all the beats, and you jumped on that and we did that. So that's what got my excitement, because like we talk about, a lot of those radio sets, I have MCs MCing over my beats, the instrumentals, Go, Ho, all these instrumentals that people know, and some things I don't think they know I made them. They know the obvious Wiley ones, or Danny Weeds, they know those tunes there, but there's a couple there that I did, and I don't think they associate me with actually being on the buttons. So it was conscious effort this time. It was nice to hear MCs over my stuff again. I wanted to be on my beats, but I wanted to hear other MCs from here on them.
Yeah.
So that was like a big motivation for this album. I knew I wasn't going to be trying to make like no big kind of pop crossover album. I was trying to maybe state my claim as a grand producer again, or the original grand producer. Again, you know what I mean? That side of it. But then it grew into other stuff as other producers started coming involved as well. Then you ended up getting them other more kind of mainstreamy but hard tunes as well. I got a couple of tunes with Splurge, whereas they bring their own flavour to it. They're really good producers. They come with some stuff. And then I ended up doing a tune with Decline, who's an old garage producer. He made I Don't Smoke the Reefer.
Yeah.
Who I met years ago on a plane to Switzerland. At least 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But then just didn't end up doing nothing until like last year.
Yeah.
And then did a bunch of stuff and ended up with this song that we've got on here now, which is a banger that I've, again, it's more vibesy, more happy. It's not just a straight MC tune where we're just trying to, like, who can have the best bars or who's the best rapper. It's more like, yeah, you could dance to it and you can sing along to it. Like, so there's those moments too. But it wasn't planned. We just got to that part.
Yeah. I love that. And it's good to hear, again, that excitement of getting people on your beats, on your production, on your thing. Now, I've got a story I wasn't sure if I'd go into or not, because I'm sure you won't remember it. But I talked about the track to Getz, actually, because on my first record, I had this track that I played...
Sorry, bro. Nick Huggett. Just I don't want Nick Huggett to think that I forgot about it. Nick Huggett. That was the other dude at XL with Toby. But go ahead.
Nick Hawks, because Nick Hawks was at XL, right?
He might have been. But I know that when Nick it came Huggett. To negotiations, it was Nick Huggett and Toby.
I love it. But so I had this track on my first record that I was talking to Getz about, because I played it at a show he was at when I was opening for Bizzle. And it was a nerve-wracking one, because everyone saw it as our anti-grime song, and it weren't.
Okay,
It was over the Billy Squires beat. So it was a cover of Fix Up, Look Sharp, essentially, that said in the details, like, respect to Dizzy, but again, people need to keep pushing the scene and keep progressing. And I remember that a weird done a festival a while back, and Semtex had played that on his radio show.
Mm.
And I know he'd come over to you and mentioned it, and you came up to me at baggage at the airport, and I'm sitting there thinking, right, he's either going to be pissed off or what's going to go on? And you just came up and said that you'd heard this, or Semtex had played you this this hit, because we did it as Hip Hop Is Art rather than Fix Up Look Sharp. And you said, yes, it's good, I like it. And I remember that moment of going, is he going to be furious? Is he going to be happy? But again, it is, not hearing you now speak of that excitement of people being on beats that you've made or you've produced or you've been involved in, that's part of the scene, right? That should be part of the excitement of it, because in those early days of grime, there was that period where people would all jump on a Nas beat or a Jay-Z beat, and you'd be competing to see who could do it better. So to get them on your beats that's a good thing.
Yeah. Do you know what it was? I guess other than the Shiesty did a version of I Love You.
Yeah.
I think that was the first time someone done a cover version or their own version.
It was a rewrite. Again, it's funny.
But what I've done was a rewrite as well.
Yeah.
So really, technically, isn't
it? Because that was it. Because that was the funny thing earlier when you were mentioning Billy Squires. Because on that record, we had a Radiohead sample that we got cleared. And everyone was like, oh, did Dizzy clear the sample? We're like, nah, we got it cleared. It's Billy Squires. Like, we didn't have to. Yeah. It was a sample anyway.
And Run DMC did it before me.
Yeah.
So I know what you're saying.
I'll wrap things up, as I've had over an hour of your time and I appreciate it. How do you feel about social media, kind of, to end this? Because it's a weird one. As you said, when you were coming up, it didn't even exist. Whereas now it does, and it's been part of the grime resurgence. It's been part of the negative side, all the stuff that's been going on with Wiley recently. And again, you don't have to comment on it, but I know he was your mentor, and then there was falling out and all this kind of thing.
I know, but you know what? Even with that, though, people, when they talk about him being my mentor and that, they just assume that because he was older than me. And if I've been introduced to them through him, they're going to look at it like that as well. But musically, we were equal.
100%, yeah.
And he got as much from me as like, really. Any tune you hear me and Wiley on, any song, I made the beat.
Yeah.
There might be one where I didn't.
Yeah.
And
that's
he
mad.
Definitely took enough influence off of me.
Or moving over style change. From Garage into the more
his whole style
change.
Yeah, definitely. But As far as anything else about what he said and all that, I don't know, man. How many times have I been on the receiving end of it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's been interesting. I've been seeing people wanting me to speak up for him or speak up against him.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you want from me?
It's the belief. it's the confused belief that it's anyone's duty. You know, everyone's a grown man.
But you know what's crazy, though? I'll give you this. It's that same paradox of, like, when people talk about Black Lives Matter and some of the narrative is that, silence is compliance.
Yeah.
So it's hearing it from that perspective, being on the other side of it, it's like, okay, right, you expect me to say something, and in the same way that some people expect you to say something.
Yeah, that makes sense, right?
But at the same time, trying to be Switzerland.
Yeah.
Trying to be neutral, but do you pick a side? Can I just say, leave me alone? I don't know. I'm all right now. But that's a problem. It's fucked.
The fact is, on all these things, there is two sides to it. Like, speaking on my opinion, the shit that he said was fucked up and unacceptable. But then equally, there's been people who have been saying unacceptable, fucked up shit on Twitter that haven't been kicked off as quickly as Wiley was. So that's a negative thing. To be blunt, white people who have said just as hateful shit for years and years on Twitter, whereas the first time a renowned black artist says something, which again I think is complete bullshit and unacceptable, gone in 2 days. So yeah, it's a... There's sides like, to all
of it. It's the first time he says stuff about Jews. So far. Yeah. Like I'm saying, it's like... Even this conversation is like, well, if you get into it, you're going to offend some people.
Yeah, yeah. Let's move on. Like, let's leave it and move on. Let's leave it and move on. So what's ahead then? Because it's weird. You're releasing new music that sounds fucking crazy exciting, but we're in this weird place. Like, you were going to be doing one of the driving gigs and it got cancelled because of COVID and all that. So what do you kind of see as the plan being on the release of this record and getting to have some energy around it?
Yeah, it just feels normal still. It just feels normal. It's like, okay, I've got no shows this year, that's all. But, like, that's calm. Like, just, the album's just going to come out. That's it. I just wanted people to hear it and enjoy it the same way. When the shows all open up and all that, and I can get to bring the music to life, because that's what it's for.
Yeah.
Like, just to bring the music to life and do your best to make it of the visual thing for people and proper experience and sharing it with... You know, I see it as nice. It's a celebration. Any show you do, it's a celebration.
Yeah.
You people have come to, like, you felt my shit that much that you've come to watch me. It's time to celebrate. Like, that's what we're doing right now. Like, and I guess that's why I made more celebration music.
It's kind of good to give them time to get to know the music as well before seeing it live, right? Because when you tour new music, the fact is, it's the old tracks that people are going to know the best. So there's all this music that you're hype about and you're excited to get out there. And then, you know...
You know what, though? I'll tell you this one time. Other than the early raves when I played some of that, like, some of the more instrumental stuff, like the Holes and the Goals, when people just went mad. But it's a different settings. And sometimes depending on what MC was on top of it as well. But there's certain songs that when I played them live the first time was crazy. Bonkers. When I played Bonkers live the first time... I couldn't believe the response.
Yeah.
I played... It was one of my shows in Liverpool. I was on tour. I played it there, It was mad.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the only time where I played a song for the
brand
first
new.
Time.
And
it had that response. I was like, I can't believe this. And that song is probably the easiest song I've ever written in my life. Like,
yeah.
And it wasn't even going to be on my album. I didn't even take it that serious. I was in Denver, so I heard that had to have been about 2008. I was doing an American tour. We was out in America, innit? I had a show in Denver that we didn't end up doing, which randomly, and then I remember walking back to the hotel and we got sent it, and they said this tune from, and I remember listening to it and not liking it that much, but because now I'd travelled, I'd been to Ibiza, I'd been to all this place and understood about dance music more.
Yeah.
That's one reference I didn't have. I didn't like house as a kid. I liked jungle. I liked heavy metal. I liked rap. I did not like house. I liked garage, but house, I didn't care. I just knew about the stuff that was on top of the pops, on Encore and Foire or Sash and all that stuff. That's what I thought, saw Bonkers as. But now with this head on, I understood that I just need to put a hook on it that's not too much. You already had the Bonkers on it, so I just wrote enough. Like, didn't write too much. I knew not to be too lyrical, because that's one of the mistakes I made with some of the stuff afterwards, is that I tried to make kind of harsey pop stuff with too much lyrics. When I started learning about it, is that music was kind of, it was all about the space and having a few things that people hung on to. So I got a bit carried away when it came to the album, the fifth. But because I see the people at the top of that tree really was Pitbull and Flo Rida. They were winning with the... But even now, that's faded. It's done.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It's done. But... And then Bonkers is actually about what I come to know now is, like, having anxiety attacks. So sometimes, I used to fall asleep in the day, because there's times I didn't have nothing to do, innit? You know, it's... That's the one when you're a musician, the artist and that, that's why it's a problem, because you're not doing normal hours like everyone else is.
Yeah.
The drug dealer becomes your mate or whatever. You're just around in the day, innit? But these days, well, like, I used to notice if I'd lie down, I'll sleep on my back, And you see, you get that thing where you can't move. I think I was having anxiety attacks because I wasn't as famous as I was after after Bonkers and Dancing Mule, after like 2010, but I was popular. And every now and then, sometimes, like, if I'd had a kip, I'd wake up and everything would hit me.
Yeah, man.
Like, rah! Like, it's not going away. Shit, this is a real thing. This is mad. Like, fucking hell. So that's what that thing is. I wake up every day as a daydream. Everything in my life ain't what it seems. I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. That's what that is actually about.
Yeah.
Like, those fucking... I think they were anxiety attacks. I don't know, but that's what Spencer. That's how I wrote that. But I ended up writing it later on in Denver. in Denver just listening to the thing in the headphones and not even writing it down. I just knew it had to be catchy enough. It was catchy enough to remember. So I came home recording it and sat on it for ages. Went to my manager and said, oh, you might want that for your album. I said, yeah? He said, yeah. And then he said, we played it on tour. And I think it's about the biggest song I've ever done. I think it might be, yeah.
That's mad, isn't it? That it was... It might not have happened. It was on the side. It wasn't even a thing. But you don't know what's going to click, I guess. That's the exciting thing about it.
Yeah, you know what I said recently? You don't choose your hits.
No, 100%.
You don't.
And as you said before as well, if you start to listen to too many outside influences, that's where it goes wrong, because you start either trying to write a hit or trying to write a song for the streets or a song for whatever else, and it's not real, rather than just going, right, what do I want to write today?
And that's the problem with social media. So get back to that point.
Yeah.
To get back to that point. Like, sometimes you really don't need to see what people think, you know?
Couldn't agree more.
You know what I mean? Because it just gets in the way. Sometimes people just need to shut the fuck up, because you think you know what you're talking about, but you're not. What is even your plan? What are you actually saying this to me for? Are you trying to, like, make me stop doing what I'm doing, or just want me to know that you're better at it, or you're sort of frustrated guy who wishes you could do it? I don't know. But a lot of the stuff that people say to you now is like, it doesn't help, innit?
Yeah, completely, completely. And again, you've got to look back and think, when you were making, again, for example, Boy in the Corner, it wasn't because people were constantly telling you what you should be doing.
Nah,
do you know what I mean?
Because that didn't sound like anything at the
time. Which is what social media is now. It's all saying, here's what you should be doing, here's what you should be doing. It's like, well, these things wouldn't have happened if I'd listened to that back then. So it's...
Yeah, I remember being in the studio with one of the younger artists a little while ago, and like I said, we were working in the same complex, and they were in that room, and I just went, like, I chat to everyone. I was going, what are you doing? Are you cool? Like, and he put something out, and it wasn't like, I said, nah, I thought, like, this is hard, I have to do... He was basically, the comments were bugging him, and he was thinking, nah, I need to come harder, because they were saying that I wasn't as hard on this tune there, so I need to come in harder, another one. And then he was explaining that, if someone says something like that and it gets more bare likes, the algorithm sends it to the top comment or some shit. And I didn't even understand, I didn't even think of that. Like, don't get me wrong, we've all been affected by comments sometimes. Because we're older, we kind of just move on a bit. But for them... That's how the world is and has been.
Yeah.
Like, comment section, they started off in the comment section. I've never been in the comment section in my life. Some of them were commenting on the videos they liked when they were growing up. Because, think, YouTube, at least, what? Two or three of my albums came out before YouTube, period.
It's mad, isn't it?
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, so I didn't have all that. Like, I couldn't tell an artist what I thought about him.
Yeah.
This is shit. It was better when you did it before. You had to send letters, fan mail, shit like that. Like, and they might not get it, but nah.
Text into Channel U or whatever else.
Come on, across. The box.
Yeah, like, the little bit at the bottom as well, just saying it is.
And even then, it was still to get a song you wanted played. You couldn't just say, your shit.
This is shit.
It's not going to get aired. Now, live call-ins, radio.
Yeah.
When you start live calling, that could be tricky. Someone might call up, like, pussy up, like, suck it up. Like, sometimes there were situations off the back of that, like, guys would just be trying to torment people. But you just, shut up, like, buck, like, that's that. What that was, innit? Like, the comment section is there, and you're, and then some people, you can even try and clean up your comment section, but you've been hit. The comments got you.
It gets through.
Yeah,
it's
man.
Mad. It's no matter how thick-skinned you are, and you can't predict it, there'll be times I'll look at comments and be like, it's all bullshit. And then there'll be one that just later that day, you're like,
yeah. And you want to tell them about themselves, but then you've played into it, and then how far do you want to go? Like, how do you want to do it? And then someone else argues with you. And then what? No, fuck you. Fuck you. And then you know what you end up with? You end up fucking, you know what I'm alluding to. You end up being the troublemaker because you had a problem. Someone commented it, then you decided to comment to everyone. Now you've got a whole lot of finger in your timeline, looking like you're very, very ignorant.
Yeah, I feel
that. And that's what it looks like. And then you're on the news.
Yeah,
looking mad.
100%. We'll leave it there.
Yeah,
I appreciate the time, man. This has been an absolute pleasure. I'm glad we could make this happen.
Yes, sir. Anytime, man.
I'm excited for new music. I can't wait. As I said, that the idea of you get Zancano on a track together,
Ocean. Am I even supposed to be saying this yet?
When's this out?
Fuck it.
It'll be in a couple of weeks. Ocean Wisdom has been the one that's just blown me away in recent years.
Mad. The tune we've got, crazy. No, we've got a few, but this one, mental.
Intricacy of that boy's flows and his lyricism crazy. Is just...
Second to none.
Layers, mate.
He's there. That's why I like to be like, do tunes with him. It works. Yeah. We work well together. Alakai Harley. I've got a tune with Smoke Boys. I've got a tune... some of the production is by... Got Steel Bangles on there, MK the Plug on like some of that drill shit. There's a bunch of stuff on there, man. Frisco, DEE's on the album. It's there, man.
I love it. Solid. Well, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
You too, brother.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. How was that? I loved having that conversation. You know, I said at the start, I've not seen many interviews with Dizzy this open and honest. And specifically, I kind of mean, like, I've never heard him talk about producing. I've never, like, as you saw, a few of the things that came up about Getz and about stuff from his youth, he hadn't really... thought about in years and certainly not spoken about. And obviously we got onto some other subjects towards the end there that people have been asking about for a minute too. So yeah, I was really appreciative of Dizzy putting aside his time for me. If you enjoyed this and this is your first time, as I mentioned in the start, check the back catalogue. I've had loads of good people. If you're more into the US side of thing, we've had Killer Mike and LP from Run the Jewels. We've had just loads of really good people from both sides of the Atlantic that might tickle your taste buds. And as I said, I don't normally tell you who's coming up, so I won't tell you next week's guest, but the week after it's Getz, and that's another really good conversation. So plenty more good shit to come. Until then, have fun, keep spreading the word, do the old like, subscribe, rate and review, give like a 5-star review, all that business. I haven't asked for that in probably a year, right? To subscribe and rate and review. I ain't mentioned that in a long time. But yeah, if you want to do all of that, that'd be lovely. I'll be back next week with more Distraction Pieces. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.